The reason is that of this unusual time is that Ali is connecting from San Francisco area, right? No.
Thank Sorry? You.
From LA.
Yes.
Yeah, sure. From Caltech. So Ali, well, usually, as you know, we have postdocs or more senior researchers doing the Cafe Club, and we usually allow only last year PhD students close to their PhD defense to present. But actually, the topic was so nice that we asked Ali, who is at the beginning of her PhD, to present these results. Ali is doing the PhD at Caltech, supervised by Olivier Doré, that I'm sure a bunch of us knows very well. So welcome, thank you, and please feel free to ask at every moment you wish, or you raise your hand in the chat. Please go ahead.
Okay, great. Let me first share screen. Okay, this is working. Yes. Great. Okay. So hello, everyone. My name is Ali, and I am a second year grad student at Caltech. Thanks for inviting me. I'm very happy to be here. So, okay. So let's jump right into it. Today, I'll talk about detecting gravitational waves with photometric surveys, and I'll also discuss the detection prospects with the Nancy Grace Roman Space Telescope. This was a project done in collaboration with Chris Pardo, Suqing Zhang, and Olivier Doré. Okay. So first, I'm sorry. Oops, sorry.
No worry.
Okay, there we go. For some reason, this is not working. But okay, so first, I would like to talk a little bit about the motivation behind finding yet another way to detect gravitational waves. So we do that by taking a brief overview at the landscape of the current or the planned gravitational wave detectors. So we start out from the very far right, from the high frequency regime in between 10 hertz all the way to several kilohertz. So in this frequency band, we have the ground-based gravitational wave detectors, such as the Advanced LIGO. So for the Advanced LIGO, the primary targets are essentially the solar mass black hole binary mergers, as well as the mergers between neutron stars. And then as we go to lower frequencies into the millihertz band, we start to have the laser interferometer space antenna going online, which is another space-based gravitational wave probe. For LISA, the primary targets are the 10 to the 5 solar mass massive black hole binary mergers. So for LISA and ALIGO, even if they operate in very different frequency regimes, their basic principles are very similar in the sense that they will detect the gravitational waves by measuring the change in the distance between fixed objects as the gravitational wave passes by. So then, as we go to even lower frequencies into the nanohertz band, we start to have a completely different type of gravitational wave detection method called the pulsar timing array. So for pulsar timing array, the detection, the primary astrophysical objects that will be interesting are these supermassive binary black hole mergers on the order of 10 to the 10 solar mass, as well as the stochastic gravitational wave background, which consists of a superposition of a lot of gravitational wave signals from sources that would otherwise be too weak to be detectable on their own. So as we look at this whole figure, we start to notice that there are certain frequency gaps that are uncovered by any planned or existing surveys or gravitational wave detectors. So there is this one between LISA and ALIGO in the decihertz range. So it is not shown on this plot, but there are actually quite a few proposals for very LISA-like space-based gravitational wave detectors that will be targeting right in this range. The one that we want to bring special attention to is this frequency gap in between 10 to the minus 7 all the way to 10 to the 6 hertz, minus 6 hertz. So within this gap, we expect a lot of very interesting sources. So for example, the mergers of the binary black holes within the range of 10 to the 6 solar mass all the way to 10 to the 8 solar mass. So having detections on this particular population will help us to improve our understanding of the merger history and evolution of these supermassive black hole binaries. From another perspective, if we can cover the entire gravitational wave frequency spectrum, we can also have the different detectors working together, such that we can detect the different stages of the same binary event or the same population of the binary event. So for example, for some of these 10 to the 8 solar mass binaries, once they enter into the LISA band, they would have already been very close to their final merger stage. So very close to their coalescence, therefore their signals will be relatively shorter. However, if we can cover this 10 to the minus 6 Hertz band, we will be able to detect the in spiral part of the signal. Having a longer signal will help us to understand a little better the waveform characteristics as well as the property of these gravitational wave sources. So from these two reasons, among many others, we know that it is desirable to have a new gravitational wave detection method. The method that we study in more detail in our project is to detect gravitational waves using astrometric measurements. The basic idea is that gravitational waves are perturbations in space-time, and astrometric measurement is essentially to infer the position of the stars using the trajectory of the photons that is detected. Since the photons will travel along very special paths in the space-time called the geodesics, a perturbed space-time leads to perturbations in the photon trajectory. Therefore, we'll infer a slightly different astrometric position of the stars, and the difference is denoted in this little schematic here as the DN. So that's the basic theory. And after we take the appropriate approximations and limits, we start to arrive at this relatively simpler form of what the deflection vector would be, how it depends on the other parameters. And in fact, we can further summarize it as this little scaling law here, where the deflection magnitude basically depends on the amplitude of the gravitational wave, as well as this angle in between the propagation direction of the gravitational wave and the direction towards the observed star. When we actually have such a source, so this here we show a little bit about what the deflection pattern would look like at different parts of the sky. This figure is essentially a flattened celestial sphere in galactic coordinates where we have a gravitational wave source where this little red star is located. These black quivers will show you the direction as well as the magnitude of the gravitational wave-induced deflections. So as you can see, we have this very distinctive quadruple pattern, which is very characteristic of gravitational wave signals. But another very important characteristic of this signal that we want to study is that the signal is periodic as it oscillates with the gravitational wave. So here, there is this little movie that illustrates what the signal would look like progress forward in time. So we can actually take advantage of the fact that the signal is periodic to separate it out from some other motions to the stars. For example, like when we have the telescope pointing error or we have the intrinsic stellar proper motion, these will not be so periodic on the time scale that we consider here. Okay, so now we have a better understanding of what the signal will look like. We want to shift gears for a little bit to talk about what are the key factors that determine the sensitivity range of a photometric survey if we actually use it as a gravitational wave probe. So first we talk about the frequency range. In a low frequency range, this little cartoon, the red trace is supposed to represent a passing gravitational wave, and the black dots are when we're making the observations on the stars. So as you can see, when the wavelength of the gravitational wave is very comparable to the survey lifetime, at very small time segments, the signal, instead of looking oscillatory, looks very linear. And this linear signal might be easily absorbed as the proper motion of the telescope, as the motion of the telescope or the pointing errors, and it might be subtracted out when we're calculating the astrometric solution. Therefore, the conclusion is that the gravitational wave that we'll be sensitive to must oscillate faster than that. At the high frequency regime, this is essentially the Nyquist-Shannon sampling theorem, in which we say that we will not be sensitive to the gravitational waves with a frequency larger than the frequency that we're taking the exposures. So in summary, the two Deciding factors for the sensitive frequency range include the total time of the survey, as well as the intervals between the exposures or the observing cadence. In terms of the resolution, the minimal gravitational wave amplitude that we'll be sensitive to, of course, scales with the astrometric accuracy, but then it also has to do with the number of stars as well as the frequency of the gravitational wave itself. So the argument is essentially that since we're measuring very small quantities, instead of looking at the deflection signal of individual stars, we really look at the correlated deflection signal for all the stars that we measure. And it is this coherence in the signal that will help us to boost the sensitivity. In terms of the gravitational wave, the argument is that if we can measure more cycles of this oscillatory pattern, then we'll have a better handle on the wave properties as well as the properties of the gravitational wave source. Okay, so in summary, some of the desirable photometric survey properties as promising gravitational wave probes include the high astrometric accuracy, the right cadence to put us in the desirable frequency range, as well as observing many stars. So a natural candidate is, of course, Gaia, which was designed to make high precision astrometric measurements on a very large number of stars. But there are also previous literature that talks about Gaia's predicted performance if we were to actually apply this method on the appropriate Gaia data. However, there is another promising candidate, which is the Roman Space Telescope, the next NASA flagship telescope after the James Webb Space Telescope. So the proposed launch date is in the mid-2020s. It offers comparable resolution as the Hubble Space Telescope, but the field of view will be 100 times larger. There are two science themes as of right now. The first one is focused on dark energy, and there's the high latitude spectroscopic and imaging survey, where a very large number of galaxies will be observed to shed light on questions on, for example, the time evolution of dark energy, as well as these large scale structures. The second one is the exoplanets, which corresponds to the exoplanet microlensing survey, during which we are surveying the stars that are very close to the galactic plane, and then look for the microlensing effects to add on to the catalog of exoplanets that are within our galaxy. So, and it is this EML survey that we'll be focusing on, which has a number of properties that makes it a little suitable for detecting gravitational waves. So first one, we have very good astrometric accuracy. It is about 1.1 milli arc second for single exposure and single source detection. And this very high astrometric accuracy will also help us to have to differentiate more stars for one particular field of views. And then in terms of the star count, on the right-hand side here, we have a more realistic depiction of what the field of view will look like in comparison with that of the James Webb Space Telescope and the Hubble Space Telescope. So we have a very wide field of view, about 100 times larger than that of Hubble, which will help us to detect more stars. And then for this particular survey, we'll be observing near the galactic center, where the stellar density is also very high. The camera has a near-infrared filter, which works in our favor since the longer wavelength photons will suffer less from extinction by the dust that are within the galaxy. So combining all the factors, it is estimated that a roughly 10 to the 8 stars will be observed during this whole survey, which is only about a magnitude smaller than what can be expected, than what Gaia achieved. And then we came to the last condition, the cadence. So the EML survey is scheduled to have 6 seasons, and each will be 72 days long. And during the 72 days, the telescope will visit 7 fields on the sky, and it will return to the same field every 15 minutes, giving a total of 41,000 exposures per source. So after we have these parameters, we can plug them back into the recipes that we just discussed, and then calculate what is the frequency range and the performance of the Roman Space Telescope EML survey. So here we have the result. And the interesting thing that we might notice in here is that it is red because of the high cadence observation of the Roman EML survey that we're able to really cover this frequency gap in between the pulsar timing array and LISA. But is this the whole story? It turns out that a parallel analysis for Gaia in this particular way will give us a rough estimate, a decent estimate of what the expected performance for Gaia would be. But for Roman EML survey, this is really only half the story. The issue turns out to be quite common for many photometric surveys, and it has to do with the difference between making a relative astrometric measurements versus the absolute ones. So the Roman Space Telescope will be able to measure the relative distances between stars that are within the single exposure very precisely, but then Gaia will be able to measure the absolute sky locations of all the stars that it measures. To translate from the relative astrometry all the way to the absolute astrometry, the commonly adopted approach is to say that let's identify several guiding stars, and then we will just match the whole exposures to the positions of these guiding stars, which have the known positions from some external catalogs. And even if we're able to do this matching very precisely, this ends up taking away a very large fraction of our expected signals. So here we have a simulated field of view with a comparable size as the field of view of the Roman Space Telescope. And as we see, the signal looks very uniform across the field of view. So this is directly a consequence of the fact that the quadruple pattern that we see earlier, it is really a global feature that will vary on the scale of tens of degrees. Whereas here, even if we have a wide field of view camera, we're really having only half a degree on the side for the field of view. So after we do the matching, after we match the whole exposure to the position of the guiding stars, all we really have left are these relative deflection signals within the field of view, which unfortunately are about 100 times smaller than what we originally expected. So after we take that into account, this is our final estimate for what the sensitivity is as of right now. So at 1 megaparsec, we see that we're only sensitive to very massive sources on the order of 10 to the 9 solar mass, which considering the realistic population model of galaxies that are in our local universe, this seems a bit unrealistic and improbable. But what about the other photometric surveys? Can we use them to also contribute meaningfully to detect gravitational waves? So here we explore several of our options. We have the ground-based telescopes, which feature very large field of views and a very flexible cadence or observing schedule. The cons is that since we're on the ground, the astrometric accuracy is a lot worse. One example is the Rubin Observatory, which observes a large number of stars and has a very wide field of view, which might also include more of that gravitational wave deflection features, variations across the sky. But then the astrometric accuracy is about 10 times worse than what we expected for Roman. The second example is a little different. So instead of making measurements on these regular stars, we take measurements of the radio sources. So the good news is that these next generation radio telescopes will have very good astrometric accuracy, but then we might not have as many stars to work with. Then there is the space-based telescopes. We have great astrometric accuracy, but then once the telescope is launched, the observing schedules will be rather will not have as much flexibility in it. And an example is the Euclid mission. So one of the reasons why Euclid might not be particularly powerful as a gravitational wave probe is particularly because of its deep survey design. So essentially, we still have this high cadence visit to the same patch of the sky, but because of the objective of the deep survey, we're pointing up really out of the galactic plane, more closer to the ecliptic poles, where the stellar density is a little less. So, and we should mention that for all these surveys that we focus on here, all these surveys will be subject to the mean subtraction process as we just discussed. But then not all hope is lost. We can think of several directions and several possibilities to improve our performance. So for example, we've been told that 0.1 milliarcsecond is really the accuracy that we could expect on a routine basis. Instead, With some engineering challenges, we might be able to achieve a factor of 10 improvement. So that would allow us to detect the same mass range of the supermassive black hole binaries, but then we extend our range from 1 megaparsec to 10 megaparsec. Option number two is really geared towards this whole mean subtraction process. So if we can design some kind of novel pointing strategy that would allow us to differentiate between the defects of the telescope motion or the pointing error away from an actual deflection in the astrometric solution of the stars, then we'll be able to regain some of that mean signal, which will boost our sensitivity dramatically. Option number three is that instead of considering the individual gravitational waves, what if we consider a superposition of many gravitational waves from a whole population of supermassive black hole binaries within our local universe? This is the option that we're currently very excited about. It's part of our ongoing work. So with one source, we see something that looked like this after we subtract out the mean. With 10 sources, this is what we see. This is 10 sources located at the same sky at the same distance away from us, but then we're having them to be randomly distributed at the sky at the angular sky locations. So as we see, we have more features once we have more sources. So for one source, we only have these collinear signatures. However, once we add in 10 sources, we see more curling that happens within the field of view. And then we also notice that the signal is larger, which works in our favor because now we know that the sources, these signals, even if we have more sources, they don't really subtract away from each other. They just keep adding on to each other, which makes it seem promising as we consider the scenario where we have more sources than just 10. So we're hopeful that a careful analysis in this direction will help us to better understand the performance, and then our initial results suggest that this will be promising and this will be a big improvement to the sensitivity of the Roman law. And we're hoping that such a careful analysis would help us to better clarify the potential of the Roma EML survey as a gravitational probe. So with that, I will conclude the talk. Thank you so much for listening, and I will take questions if there are any. Thank you.
Thank you. Carlo, you are not there? So Carlo,
a technical issue.
Carlo is offline, apparently. Maybe, I don't know, if someone has questions, well, don't hesitate, of course. I don't see anything in the chat. So maybe I can start with, I have at least two questions. My first question is the plot that you have shown us at the end, for example, this is a simulation. This is not something that we have observed. This is a test that we can hope to observe.
So which plot are you referring to?
This one, for example.
Oh, okay. Yes. So these are simulated signals, and These are just randomly populated for randomly populated stars within the field of views. Mm-hmm. And then you fix these hypothetical supermassive black hole binaries and then predict what is their combined signals. Yes. And of course, we also, so to consider a realistic distribution of these sources, we're also using some galaxy catalogs that would allow us to have a better understanding of where exactly the gravitational waves could come from for the real life situation, I guess.
Okay, and in the plot of the left here, you have, when you say you have 10 sources, so you have 10 emitters of gravitational waves who and for example, if you because the basic idea was what you said at the really beginning, like in your first or second plot, I don't really remember where you have only one sources and one star, and here when you say you have 10 sources, this is 10 binary black holes, for example.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. And yeah, in fact, my second question was about that, because how can you if you have because in your first plot what you measured was the change of observed size of a star, if I remember correctly, in your very first slide, I think, or second. Yeah, that one. So dn is the size of a star, which depends of the gravitational waves emitted by the source. Where here you have in that case you have only one source.
Yeah. I see. So the dn is actually the deflection vector of the stars. Mm-hmm. So the star will be, originally here. This is its true position. But then when the gravitational wave passed by, it will move to this position. So for all the sources that we consider in the current study, we're only considering point sources. So we are ignoring the distortions to the size. But then we can also consider what will happen for extended sources. For extended sources, there might be some distortions. Even though it could be very small, it might still be very interesting signals.
Okay, so then is the change in the position of the star, yes. A really naive question is, how do you know the real position of the star? Because you see the star move the with the n, or you only see that for a short time because the wave is passing. This is.
Right, yes, that's a very good question. So the thing is, the way that it's set up right now, you don't, at every single point in time, if you only have one exposures, then yes, you do not know what is the true position of the stars. Mm-hmm. However, if you can observe many cycles of these oscillations, you can try to measure, if your telescope is stable enough to measure these measure the oscillatory signature of this deflection signal, then you can use a time average to establish a baseline that will tell you what is the true position of the stars. Yes, but then for each, if you only have one single exposure, then the short answer is that you don't know.
Okay, so thank you very much. Okay. Is there questions?
Okay, maybe I have a question, you know?
Please.
So, yeah, I have a question on the assumptions that you are doing on this distance P of the supermassive black hole. What is the kind of hypothesis that you take for the distance?
So, the distance to these... So, essentially, so are you asking about a more realistic estimate?
Yeah, when you are doing the simulation at the end, where you put different random events on the field...
Yes.
Yeah. So what are the assumptions that you take for the distance of this event?
Right. Okay. So the parameter that we're varying in our, so basically we're doing a large MCMC simulation to this. And when we say the kind of sources that we might detect, actually you can see it on this page. Yeah. So here, we see that the magnitude of the signal, which is what we're basically MCMC over, this parameter will depend on the luminosity distance away to these supermassive black holes. Mm-hmm. So here, essentially, we can think of this combination of the chirp mass of the supermassive binary black holes. And the luminosity distance, we can combine them into another scaled mass, which then we can vary. So for the same scaled mass, if you have a more massive system, then you're able to probe into larger distances. For if you have a lighter system, you can still have the same scaled mass, but then you will only be sensitive to a very short range. So as we mentioned in the final sensitivity plot here, okay, so let me scroll back. Okay, so for this plot over here, this line, essentially every black hole binaries on this line, so all the black hole binaries that are shown over here, they will have a similar scaled mass, but instead, if we fix their distance, for example, in this case, to be 1 parsec, this is what the trip mass range corresponds to. If we fix another distance, so say 10 megaparsec, then we would have a more stringent condition on what the mass of the supermassive black hole needs to be. Does that answer your question?
Yes, but do you consider like galaxy at redshift 1 or stuff like this? Because that the distance would be much larger, right?
Right. So far in here, this is only, the situation here, when we are doing this particular test, we do not consider any realistic positions of the galaxies or where these supermassive black holes might be more probably located. But in future work, that is definitely part of the question. We're using a lot of these catalogs of the galaxies to infer what are the more probable positions or the distances, as you mentioned, to these supermassive, to these gravitational wave sources, essentially.
Okay. So for the moment, you assume basically that they are inside our galaxy or something like that.
Sorry, could you repeat?
For the moment, you assume that they are not far from our galaxy or inside our galaxy.
Sorry, I couldn't quite hear the signals a little. Sorry, could you repeat your question?
Sorry, my connection is really bad. I don't hear very well the answer. So no, that's fine. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Carlo, I think you said you are back.
No? Yeah, hello, I'm back. Okay. I'm back. I'm sorry. I got some trouble with the connection. So I missed maybe some question or point. And I had a question. Did you try this before, or are you foreseeing to test the method with appropriate numerical simulations?
Sorry.
Are you testing, or did you test with the method with the n-body simulations, with numerical simulations in general?
Right. Yes. Okay. So for So when you refer to the n-body simulations, do you mean that will help us to better understand the population of these supermassive black holes?
Well, all the possible systematics and physics is the most reliable and realistic way. I mean, so the gravitational wave signals and the population distribution of sources to perform the astrometric measurements and
yes
and eventually also different redshifts, which is maybe a question that is connected to what Olivier was asking. I mean, are you foreseeing to apply this? Is possible to apply the same technique to larger redshift, up to which redshift?
Yes. Okay. Okay, sounds good. Thank you. Thank you for the questions. So let's go through them. So for the gravitational wave source, here our model is very simple. So here, as you can see from our initial slides here, we're only modeling the gravitational wave source, the gravitational waves only up to the leading term. We can definitely include more terms to it, which will make it more precise and make the model to include more gravitational wave features. But then, since considering our sensitivity here, all these higher order terms, they will be so insignificantly small that they will not make a very large difference to the detection prospects. So that's one of the questions. And the other question is about the population of these sources. So that is definitely something that we want to consider, because then, as you can imagine, the gravitational wave amplitude scales inversely with the distance. But then, if we can consider a whole population, the number of sources that we expect within a certain volume actually scales with the distance cubed. So ideally, if we include them up to a larger distance, we will have a very stronger signal. So that is definitely one of the reasons why we're interested in considering a population of these sources. And so far, we're not at the n-body simulation stage yet. We're only extracting the positions of these galaxies galaxies from these galaxy catalogs, such as the two-mass catalog and also the NASA Sloan Atlas. So we're currently still using that, but definitely to incorporate more theoretical simulations for how many you may expect in the local universe will be helpful. And then the next question is about the redshift. So unfortunately, the current performance is telling us that we are only sensitive to sources that are very close to us within very small redshift. So for example, at 250 megaparsec, you only have 0.05, I think, redshift, or is that 0.5? Right, so if you go to very very far away and you want to go to very interesting redshifts, for example, redshift 1 or 2 or 3, then based on our current performance, you will need incredibly more massive gravitational wave sources. And our entire method will depend on the fact that you sort of have some idea of where the gravitational wave is coming from. And in that sense, you will have to first essentially know where the gravitational wave source is and then use this method to verify some of its parameters. Right, so that's the answer to that question.
Yeah. Is the precision provided by advanced LIGO, Virgo, and Kagra sufficient enough for these purposes, or do you really need LISA?
Right. Yes. So I wanted to also comment on that. So the ones that the LIGO detector and the Virgo detector they will detect, they're much lighter systems. So they're typically tens of solar mass systems, and so tens of solar mass, even if they're close to us, they are not strong enough to produce a detectable signal in this particular case. So there may be, right, and that is because the ground-based detectors, they will be limited by ground motions, so seismic motions and things, so they will not be sensitive to these supermassive black hole binaries at all.
Okay, thank you. Guillaume, you're chairing the questions, maybe.
Well, in fact, I have one more question myself, but I don't know if someone else want to ask.
I don't see any right hand. Let's see. Yeah. Go ahead.
So, from what you just said 2 minutes ago, your signal will be dominated by very far away sources because of this you have much more sources far away. This is what you just said now a few minutes ago, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
In that case, I suppose that this you won't really measure what we see in this picture, because here you have an idealized case with just one source. And
yes. So that's a very good question. So it's true that we'll be sensitive to. So the more volume that we include, the larger the signal is. The larger the signal is theoretically. But there is an issue in the sense that here, a lot of our process to improve the performance and then basically lower the detection threshold is to use the fact that the signal is oscillatory. But as we include more binaries out to further distances, we will start to migrate from this analysis on individual sources or a collection of sources with known positions all the way to this gravitational wave background, this style of signal. So those are two completely different kind of signals in a sense, and the ways to analyze them will be very different. So for example, here we're saying that our basic method is to say we predict this pattern that we know comes from these several of these gravitational wave sources. But then as we have many of them and our uncertainty about their positions and their distance uncertainties becomes larger and larger, we start to migrate towards another way to analyze, which is more closer to the power spectrum sort of way. So in that case, much like the stochastic background detection for the PTAs, we're not looking at just one oscillatory signal. We're looking at the whole power spectrum of across a frequency range, and then that will help us to to get a handle on the strength of this gravitational wave background. So yes, there is a certain point at which we cannot increase our volume without changing our method of analysis. But so far our initial analysis has been operating on the assumption that since we have these galaxy catalogs, if we don't go to too far of a distance, then we still have a decent handle on exactly their positions and their distance from us.
Okay, thank you.
Great, thanks.
I don't see any other raised hands, so maybe we can stop here. And thank you again, Ali. I don't remember if you advertised your paper, so I'm gonna put it in the chat. Okay.
Thank you.
It's fine. To everybody, let's see next week on Wednesday as usual. And thank you, everybody. Bye bye.
Thank you.
Bye bye.
Ali, thank you again.
Yeah.